Thank you, Julia. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Whoops, let me just get this in the right place. There, that looks right to you. Okay, that's all good. I was thinking about the date of this symposium, and I realize we're just a month short of the third anniversary of the passage of the Affordable Care Act. So it was March 23rd, 2010. That's when the president signed it. And Obamacare became the law of the land, a little bit disputed, but the law of the land. And we're going to have another anniversary about a year from now, because it is in January of 2014 that the bulk of the law, its expanded coverage provisions, actually go into effect, extending coverage to tens of millions of Americans who are now without health insurance. It's no small accomplishment, because health insurance matters. Americans like to think, and you see this on poll after poll, we like to think, that everybody in this country gets health care when we need it. But it's not true. We've got reams of evidence that tell us that people without health insurance get care later than people who have health insurance. They get less care, and as a result, they are more likely to die because they don't have health insurance. And the Institute of Medicine has documented that about 20,000 Americans die every year because they don't get health care, because they don't have health insurance. But implementation of the Affordable Care Act is going to occur in a very contentious political environment. It's challenged by its critics as a massive overreach of federal power and a big government takeover of our healthcare system. In short, it's pretty much the end of healthcare as we know it. Now, clearly, I'm a fan. I'm not going to hide that. I am a fan. It will be clear. But I don't want to ask you to trust me on whether it's an overreach. I'm going to lay out the problems that the law is designed to address, and then we'll see what you think about it. The fact is that most of the U.S. health insurance system, and it really is directed, the law is directed primarily at the financing system, most of the U.S. health financing system works pretty well, or works pretty well, better said, for most of us. But huge numbers, now about 50 million people, we're a big country, so 50 million of our 300 million people, systematically fall outside the health insurance system. Now, the part that works is employer-sponsored health insurance. The vast majority, while you're in law school, I don't know how you're insured, but I imagine many of you have had coverage, have jobs with coverage, yes? Okay, right? So you know that that's how you got it, that's how most Americans get their health insurance coverage. And the truth of the matter is, as I've learned in my practical experience, Americans pretty much want to keep what they have. That's how come Obama promised precisely that. Over the first half of the 20th century, the policy and the political process, every 10, 20 years or so, killed any kind of public health insurance that was being developed in European countries. And employer-sponsored health insurance emerged in its absence, stimulated by some players' efforts to fend off public insurance and by others to make sure that people had some health insurance. Insurers found a way to market health insurance effectively, and I'll say more about that in a sec, by marketing large groups. The problem is that if you're just selling to an individual at a time, you've got a concern that sick people will sign up and healthy people won't. Can't make insurance work that way, right? We need to spread risk so that among a large pool who don't know whether they're going to get sick, so the healthy, we can pay when we're healthy for those of us that get sick. So the way the private market did that was to market to employers. That's what insurers did. And employers who were motivated either by achieving employee loyalty offered coverage, or by efforts to fend off unions. All of that led to a major expansion of employer-sponsored health insurance in the 1940s and 1950s. In the 50s, the advantage of getting coverage through your job was locked in by changes or in the tax code that made it such that when your employer pays your health insurance premium, that's not treated as taxable income to you. So what that means, if your employer gives you a dollar and you pay, you're in the 15% tax bracket, you would only have 85 cents to go buy health insurance on your own. But if the employer pays that as a health insurance premium, you've got a full buck, so that it makes it very advantageous to get health insurance through employment. The problem is that low-wage workers in large and small businesses, so it not just a small business problem, but lots of uninsured in large businesses too, that they never got reached by this mechanism. The reason being, they're in low-wage jobs. Low-wage jobs are low-benefit jobs. One doesn't compensate. They're just low-compensation jobs across the board. Lousy job is a lousy job. So the system never reached them. And even as it grew to cover about 80% of Americans in its heyday, and when it was at the top, it was leaving out, excluding this population of workers. And in the 1980s, as health costs continued to rise and the economy stalled, the expansion of employer-sponsored insurance, it had been growing all those years, it stalled too. And it stopped keeping up with the growth in the workforce, so that year after year, more and more Americans were finding themselves without health insurance. The number of uninsured Americans who are mostly workers, but they're workers in low-paid jobs that don't offer health insurance, began to grow. And even in the best of economic times, every time we had a recession, the uninsured would grow. And then even in the 90s, when the economy was booming, we never reached the levels of coverage, the share of workers' coverage that we had in the 80s. So the numbers of uninsured kept growing. The fact of the matter is that employer-sponsored insurance, even with this tax benefit that costs us a couple of $100 billion every year, employer-sponsored insurance inevitably falls short and keeps falling further behind. All right, so that's how most of us get insurance, but it's not the only way you can get insurance. So if you don't get health insurance in your job, you go buy it on your own. Have many of you done that? That's kind of interesting. Okay, I'm not going to look at you, but we do, so we'll keep your story quiet. But there's a market out there. We call it the non-group market. Sometimes it's referred to as the individual market, but it's not quite right because it can be individuals and family. So the technical name is the non-group, so it's outside of the largely employer group insurance. But this is the market that is pretty much broken. So we got employer-sponsored insurance working pretty well. This is the first part of the current market that I'm going to tell you is broken. Insurers in the non-group market are afraid, just like we talked about a few minutes ago, they're afraid that people are only going to buy health insurance when they need it. Again, that's not going to work. So insurers, in order to protect themselves and to keep a business viable in these circumstances, very actively screen us to make sure that they are not getting us just because we need health care. So if you have ever tried to get coverage in this market, you will find that you are usually examined. You fill out forms. You can be examined. And we know about the term pre-existing conditions, but things like allergies, asthma, even hay fever, things like that can lead to denials of coverage or coverage except not your respiratory system. I've even heard it sounds like a joke, but it's real. An insurer that would cover somebody's left side, not their right side, because of previous illness. So it leads to either restrictions on coverage, what's actually going to get covered, or it can lead to a very high price or the denial of benefits coverage altogether. So that's, although I too can throw around rhetoric about greedy insurers, they're just, it's businesses. I mean, this is what they do in order to keep their markets viable. Now, at the same time, they offer limited benefits because, you know, you say that there is an argument you hear sometimes that it's just too expensive to buy insurance on your own. And that is true if your income is low and if they're charging you a very high rate. But insurers work hard because medical care is expensive. They want to keep the price low enough to sell to healthy people, particularly healthy young people. And so in order to keep the cost low, they not only screen out sick people, but they limit the benefits. So you'll find that what would for many people be an affordable level of coverage is not going to cover medications. It's not going to cover mental health. It's not going to cover maternity care. And it's going to have limits, annual limits on benefits. Some of it is really pretty useless. But even relatively decent is going to have quite limited coverage. The result is that this non-group health insurance market does not work to provide a safety net for those folks who are not getting coverage through their jobs. It's not available to some, to those who have pre-existing conditions and broadly defined. That can be a lot of us. And even if you get it, it's not providing you what you would think of as decent health insurance coverage. If it's got an annual limit that falls well below the cost of a catastrophic illness, that's not the kind of health insurance that you want to have. It's not really worthy of the name. So that's the broken non-group market. We got another option that could fix this hole in employer-sponsored insurance, and that would be our public safety net. You know about the Medicaid program, the federal-state Medicaid program, right? A lot of people think, and a lot of experts will actually say that Medicaid is for poor people. Problem is, it's not for all poor people. We have a history in this country of distinguishing between deserving and undeserving poor, and the deserving poor categories start with kids. And so Medicaid along with an additional, modest in size, but an add-on to the Medicaid program called CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. It does pretty well in covering kids, well above the poverty level. Children can be eligible for coverage through Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicaid, so it does pretty well by kids. Women, when they're pregnant, back to that kid again, pregnant women are covered up to levels at income levels well above poverty by the Medicaid program. But you're not in such good shape if you're an able-bodied adult. Medicaid, if you're disabled, yes, and poor and disabled, Medicaid covers you, but if you're an able-bodied adult, if you are a parent of a dependent child, you are eligible for coverage. But the income eligibility in most states is so low that if you're earning the minimum wage, you're too rich for Medicaid coverage. Those are parents. And if you're not a parent of a dependent child, except in some states that have waivers from federal rules, have made deals with the federal government to expand coverage. In most states, doesn't matter how poor you are, if you are not a parent of a dependent child, you are not eligible for Medicaid. Now, that bottom line is that means, and when I said that the system that we've got systematically excludes millions of Americans, it's because the same low-wage workers who don't get coverage through their jobs, large proportion of them are the same people who are excluded from the public system as well. They just fall through a giant crack in our healthcare system. and it's that crack that the Affordable Care Act is aiming to seal. I'm going to tell you now how it does that, and it's aiming to do it going back to saying that most people have employer-sponsored coverage and want to keep it. The challenge in writing this law was to be able to cover the people outside who fall outside the employer-sponsored insurance system without messing much with the coverage that people are getting through their jobs. So I'm going to lay out to you how it is that the law does that, and I want to start with the part that it leaves pretty much alone, and that is employer-sponsored coverage. The law barely touches the kinds of, doesn't say anything about the benefits that large employers have to offer. There are some very modest changes that are referred to as a patient bill of rights that all insurance has to offer, and that is prevention benefits, women's benefits, and that's an area of contention, but that's where the contraception battle is all about. That's all insurance coverage has to offer that. Employer-sponsored insurance can't set annual limits or lifetime limits on coverage, or another issue is rescissions, take away your benefits just because you get sick. Has to cover your allow your kids to be on your policies to age 26. If there's a denial of coverage, it has to allow you an appeal. You can't really sue about it. You can't go to court you can't go to state court. But you can appeal a denial, which is an improvement. But no other specification of benefits. And the costs of these new benefits are really tiny in the scheme of insurance. So it's really quite modest. Now, the businesses of 50 or more do face a penalty if their workers can't afford the share of the premium they have to pay for the employer, or if the benefit is so lousy it's covering less than 60% of the services that are covered, if it has extremely high cost sharing. If one of those workers goes into the newly created markets I'm going to talk about in a minute and gets a subsidy, then the employer gets a penalty. But the fact is that except for very small employers, almost all employers now offer coverage. So, and if you are offered employer coverage, you're not allowed to go get a subsidy. So the penalty is not really binding on employers. And when you hear that, employers are going to drop coverage because of these, they'd rather take the penalty because the penalty is cheaper than the cost of coverage. Remember, they're offering coverage now. Nobody's requiring it. They're not being penalized. They offer it. Why? Because we get a good tax benefit in employer-sponsored insurance, much better for most of us than the subsidy you'd get under the Affordable Care Act. And that's where we want to get coverage. That's where people, that's part of getting a good job. So employer-sponsored insurance may continue and is projected to continue to decline. That's a graph. I'm not starting at the top. I feel like I should be taller to do this for you. It's going to go down, but that's because of what's been going on for years: cost of insurance going up and a lousy labor market. So, but that's not because of the Affordable Care Act and the projections by the Congressional Budget Office and the RAND Corporation and the Urban Institute all say that employer-sponsored insurance stays pretty much steady at projected levels after the Affordable Care Act goes into effect. So what does, that's what it leaves alone, the ACA. Now let's look at what it fixes. It means if this market is deteriorating, we need a place outside of coverage, outside of employers, for people to get meaningful coverage. And that's where there is a big change under the Affordable Care Act. And when I talk about the pieces of that change, I'm sure they're all going to be familiar to you because we all talked about them for months and saw them litigated before the Supreme Court. So this is going to be pretty familiar. What the Affordable Care Act does is create, or actually authorize, or states to create, or the feds if they don't, effective marketplaces for insurance marketplaces for people who don't have or are not offered employer-sponsored insurance. They call them exchanges, although I gather that term is going out of style, so we're just going to call them marketplaces, right? So it takes three steps to create the marketplace, both inside and outside the exchange. The first is to make sure that, unlike current law or unlike the current marketplace, that insurance is available to everybody regardless of health status. So we make new rules on the ACA for insurers. They got to take everybody who comes, and they've got to charge them. They set their own rates, but they can't vary rates based on health status. They can charge smokers more. They can charge older people more than younger people, but the boundaries on that are limited, 3-to-1. They can't charge the oldest more than 3 times the level of the youngest. In the current market, it's about 5 or 6-to-1. So they make new rules, got to take all comers. Well, remember, we talked about insurers have been working really hard to not be able to not get people just when they're sick, and if you just require them to take everybody and don't do everything else, gonna fall apart. Hence, what we used to call the individual mandate. Now, we don't call it that anymore after the Supreme Court decision. We call it a tax on the uninsured, or if we're being politically correct, we're calling it a legally required contribution if you don't have health insurance. So the purpose of the individual mandate is to make sure that insurers can count on getting a good risk pool and not just people when they're sick. And we can talk about, although I'm not a fool, I don't know how much I want to engage a lot of law students about whether or not this is like requiring everybody to eat broccoli, but if you want to have that conversation, game on, so no problem. Okay, now, the next thing that happens is that you can't, if you think about the logic, you can't require everybody to buy health insurance, which is not cheap, if they don't have money. I mean, you can't get blood from stones. So you gotta subsidize it. Now, the first thing is to know that there is an exemption from the requirement for people with low incomes. So a significant portion of the uninsured are exempt from the requirement. So nobody's requiring people who have no money to pay money they don't have. And then for people with incomes above 138, from 138% of poverty to, above poverty because of, we'll come to that in a minute, to 400% of poverty, there are subsidies that vary with income to make this insurance that we've now made available to make it affordable. And this is where this insurance does have benefit requirements, and that's the third A. You think we're making it available, we're making it affordable, and we're making it adequate. This insurance in the non-group and the small group market, the business is less than 50, in this market, insurers selling in this market have to offer a specified set of benefits. You've seen some discussion about that in recent days because some of those regulations just came out. They're called essential health benefits. And as designed in the regulations promulgated by the Department of Health and Human Services, the benefit package in that law, is based on what is the predominant practice in the state, what's being sold to small groups, pretty much. That's the nature of the benefit package. Now, you might think that this is all very generous and that we're providing very extensive coverage, but just to give you a benchmark on the coverage level that people will have when they get subsidies, they will get coverage that pays for 70% of the value of the health and of the services covered by the insurance. Not every individual, but on average, that it's called actuarial value. It'll cover 70% of actuarial value. If you are a member of Congress or you're working for the federal government and get standard Blue Cross Blue Shield, that covers about 85% of the services. So it is a much, much more of this benefit you have to pay that is covered out of your own pocket. And there are subsidies, again, that cover help low-income people with some of that coverage. But it is not a particularly extensive benefit package. So the subsidies apply in the new marketplace, in the exchanges where people are going to go get to shop and choose their own insurance plan, and that's what we're busy arguing about. I'll talk about that more in a minute. There's the establishment of exchanges, but there you've got the picture of the overall picture of how the Affordable Care Act is aiming to fix a broken non-group market so that people who don't get employer-sponsored coverage have a place to go. So what about the safety net? Are we gonna fix that too? And that is an equally important change in the market. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, when they estimated how many people would get coverage under the Affordable Care Act, the total is about 30 million people. And you have about half of those likely to be covered through these new subsidies or tax credits that you get through the exchanges. And the other half, if every state adopts the Medicaid expansion that I'm now going to describe, you also get about 15 million. So it's about half and half. So the Medicaid fix is really pretty simple. Remember, I talked about how you don't get coverage if you're not eligible for Medicaid, no matter how poor you are, even if you are an adult who's not a parent of a dependent child. And eligibility levels for other categories of families vary from state to state. What the law says is that every state, or Medicaid, the law said that everybody, as written, as the Congress wrote it, the law said that every state was required to cover all people under in Medicaid whose incomes fell below 133% of poverty. That's about $15,000 for an individual or $31,000 for a family of four. You will see different things. Sometimes we talk about it as 133% of poverty. Sometimes you see 138% of poverty. It's because the law says 133%, but then allows the in determining eligibility, disregards the first 5% of income. So it means it's 138%, but that's roughly what's covered. So what that means is that everybody, everywhere, the safety net becomes the same if states, and the law, that if states were required to make the safety net the same across the nation. And the feds are paying for that, 100% for the first 3 years, and then 90%, which is different from standard Medicaid. Standard Medicaid, the minimum match that a state gets is 50%, and it goes up to about 80%, varying inversely with the state's average income, so that lower income states get higher matches, higher income states get lower matches. This one is pretty much all at federal expense. Now, I'm going to talk about how this is being implemented, but my point here is to tell you this is the fix of the safety net. I've described to you the fix of the non-group market, and the bulk of the system, employer-sponsored insurance, left largely alone. So the rules are working around the employer-sponsored insurance system, and if that's not enough to tell you that it's not a federal takeover, the law is designed so that the federal government does not intend to be the one that is putting these rules into effect. It, on the contrary, it's putting tens of billions of dollars in the hands of states to build their insurance markets and design their exchanges, to design their benefits, to pay for the uncompensated care that state and local governments now pay for. That's when you pay a hospital for whatever care they do provide. to people who can't, who don't have insurance, so it's replacing, it's filling that hole, to run their Medicaid programs, and in short, by putting all this money into states to grow their economies. So what's the fuss? This is big government. So let me throw out a couple of reasons that people might argue that it's destroying healthcare as we know it. Is it going to break the bank? Is it going to drive up the federal deficit? Well, fact is that it's paid for. That through a combination of reductions in payments that are being made under the Medicare program, largely to hospital and post-hospital providers, that's about half of what pays for this law. The other half is taxes, predominantly on higher-income people. The extension of the hospital insurance, the HI tax that we pay as part of FICA, that's the bulk of where the tax money is coming from. So it is paid for. In fact, it takes more out in it has in the combination of taxes and reduced Medicare spending generated something of a surplus, and it actually has a little bit of deficit reduction in the law. It's so much so that when the Congressional Budget Office asked to estimate what the cost of repealing the Affordable Care Act would be, hiked the deficit. Cost money, didn't save money. So. That one doesn't work. What about, is it going to drive up the already clearly, in my view, unacceptably high healthcare costs? That's a longer story. I'm happy to talk more about what drives healthcare costs. But the law not only slows the growth of per capita Medicare spending dramatically, getting rid of some overpayments in the law, so much so that amazingly the per capita Medicare costs grew at zip last year. So really has slowed the growth. Not only that, it has launched changes in payment methods that Medicare employs and the private sector typically follows. We'll see whether they in fact do, to promote coordination of care and stimulate changes in provider behavior so that we get away from the mechanism that does drive healthcare costs, which is that we reward providers for delivering more and more and more expensive services, and instead create a new payment system that rewards them for delivering effective care efficiently. So it's not that issue. So I'm going to give you my interpretation. It seems to me that the fuss is about politics and values. It's not about the specifics of Obamacare. It is, after all, called Obamacare not because people so love the president and are so thrilled by the Affordable Care Act. It's because they don't like President Obama. It is an epithet, not an affectionate term. And the fact is that on this issue, like so many others, Democrats and Republicans are completely at opposite poles. So if Democrats like it, then Republicans hate it. And what you see as the law is being implemented, that Republican governors are extremely reluctant to play along with Obamacare despite the rewards that their state is facing if they do play. Now, we see that in both of the areas I told you about, both the Medicaid side and the fix of the non-group market. So now, since the Supreme Court ruled that the law could not make Medicaid, not require states to extend Medicaid, as I've described, it's up to states to choose, there has been some uncertainty, there still is uncertainty as to whether or not states will actually offer that extension. But we're seeing, and I don't know whether you saw, but yesterday Rick Scott became the eighth Republican governor who just can't turn down such a good deal. Now, they argue the contrary, but there are a lot of money on the table. They just can't turn it down. So looks like, although some states may still hold out, I understand our own governor seems to still be on the fence on this one, but it looks like the states are likely to come along on the Medicaid side. Not so much on the setting up of the exchanges side, where the about half the states have said that they are going to develop their own exchanges. And this all now has to be, they have to start enrolling people or giving people information next October. So we need to move this sucker along, right? So we now have about half the states that say they're going to do it, and about half the states that say they aren't. And the law says that if the states don't do it, then the feds will do it for them. So the odd situation here is that they actually are asking the feds to come on in rather than do this themselves. Why? Well, my view is they are rooting for failure, right? It's Obamacare. It's the Democrats' problem. Let the Democrats handle it, and they will. And the fact is, in my view, in politics in general, that affordable health care is just one of the many issues on which the political parties are deeply divided, leaving Americans who are struggling with, shall we say, a challenging economy to keep on keeping on as best they can. For them, the modest changes in our health insurance system that the Affordable Care Act makes are going to be a huge help. Now, I don't know if I have convinced you that Obamacare is not a federal takeover, but boy, would it be easier to implement this law if it were. What I've described to you is not a pretty picture or an easy law to put into place. It's got a lot of moving parts and a lot of independent actors, and its implementation in a hostile political environment is not going to make it an easy or a smooth proposition. But tough as implementation will be, enacting law that will extend affordable health care coverage to as many as 30 million people and provide them access to health care when they need it is, in my view, one hell of an accomplishment. I'm proud to be working to make it work. And I would love to have you join me because God knows we're going to need your help. Thanks.